Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Pope Francis is coming to our fair city, to Washington, D.C. He has finished his time in Cuba. He's coming to Washington, Philadelphia, and New York. And we're expected to have extremely large crowds in all three places. I do not envy those that have to handle all the crowds and the security for the Pope. But it is a very important visit. It's a very important time. And this Pope is a Pope that, well, a lot of progressives have praised, including me. Now, I'm not saying he has all the views I have. He obviously still sticks to his Catholic doctrine, opposed to same-sex marriage, opposed to abortion and things like that. But for a Pope and for a church that is certainly embodied with a long tradition, I would say that Pope Francis has moved the church farther and faster than any Pope I can recall in my time. But the Pope's visit has brought a lot of attention to the question of religion and politics. It's fascinating because a lot of liberals praise the Pope, while a lot of conservatives are now saying, hey, you know, I don't make up my mind based on the Pope. I decide based on what I decide. It's ironic because those kinds of things used to be said by liberals. Liberals used to be the ones that were challenged to give their religious reasons for why they believe what they believe. And it was conservatives that said, hey, liberals, why don't you follow church teaching? Now it's just fascinating to see conservatives on the defensive, particularly when it comes to questions of poverty. Whatever you think about abortion or same-sex marriage, I think we can agree that Jesus doesn't talk very often about either one of them. In fact, the New Testament makes no mention of abortion, and the four Gospels makes no mention of homosexuality. These are not issues that you see very often in any part of the Bible. On the other hand, taking care of the poor, looking out for the hungry, taking care of the widow, the orphan, taking care of one another, well, that's in virtually every chapter of the Bible. The Bible begins with the great question asked by God, am I my... Well, actually, it's Cain, after he kills his brother Abel, who asks God, ironically, am I my brother's keeper? And it seems the whole rest of the Bible answers, yes, 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 you are. You are to take care of one another. And Pope Francis, by focusing on the poor, by focusing on the dispossessed, by focusing on those who don't have power, is a direct challenge to the conservatives in this country that very much do not want to transfer power from a very small group of very wealthy people into a middle class, a working class, or dare I say, even the poor. So this is a direct challenge to conservatives, and many of them are being asked by progressives to respond to what the Pope says. And while that feels good for us, I do have to remind you that it might not feel good if the shoe were on the other foot. What if there were a conservative Pope? What if we were asked, you know, why don't you support the Pope's view on abortion or on same-sex marriage? At which point I would say, well, you know, I'm not Catholic. I don't have to obey the Pope. Or even Catholics can say, you know, I'm an American. The Pope is a nice guy. He's in Rome, but I don't have to do everything he says. John F. Kennedy, when he ran for president, famously said, hey, don't worry that I'm Catholic. I don't take orders from the Pope, because that was a concern in 1960. He said, nope, I don't take orders from the Pope. I am Catholic, but, you know, I'm in charge, not the Pope. Now it's interesting to see the conservatives say the same thing in response to climate change and caring for the poor and the other things that I'm very happy that Pope Francis brings up. But I think all of this raises a larger question of the role, if any, that religion should play in politics. It's very easy as a liberal to say, as I do, that there's a separation of church and state, that the First Amendment to the Constitution says that Congress shall not establish a religion, nor prohibit the free exercise thereof. And there is this wall of separation between church and state. That's Thomas Jefferson's words. I didn't make that up. The idea is that if the church gets involved in state business, then suddenly you are legislating morality. You are requiring people who are not of your religion to follow your religion. And none of us seem to like that kind of theocracy. We can think of the Taliban. We can think of Kim Davis. We can think of, oh, how would it be if the majority religion doesn't eat pork, or the majority religion celebrates Sabbath on a different day, or the majority religion insists that all the women wear burqas. Whatever it is, none of us would like that very much. No matter what our religion is, we understand that in America we have the right to choose our faith. We do not want the government telling us which faith to believe. That's why I'm opposed to, for example, government-sponsored prayer. I don't think government should be telling us which way to worship God. That's between us, our family, our church, our synagogue, our mosque, or no religion at all. We have every right to be an atheist in America, and sometimes I think people forget that. But just like religion can wrongly infect the government, government can wrongly infect religion. Just like I don't want churches telling our government what to do, I don't want our government telling churches what to do. One of the things that really concerned me when George Bush had his faith-based initiative back when I worked in Congress a little over a decade ago, and I worked very hard to stop that faith-based initiative, one of the concerns was, well, a bunch of churches, in order to get federal funds, might just change their views. You can understand a minister from the pulpit who needs $10,000 for a new church steeple might just not attack the Bush administration very much if they think the Bush administration is going to give them a bunch of money. That's a real problem. Government can infect religion too, and I don't think the government should be telling religions what to do. Now, some of this comes down to what is religious freedom? We know the conservatives say, aha, you don't want government telling religions what to do? Well, then don't make a marriage clerk serve same-sex couples. Don't make a baker open their bakery to gay people. Don't allow women who work for religious organizations to get reproductive services because the Catholic Church and is against contraception, not to mention abortion. And to me, to divide this line, to make it really clear where the wall of separation between church and state should be, I bring it down to the individual. And I say I always support the option that is most consistent with individual freedom. In other words, the government should never be requiring a religious person to do something that they themselves find offensive with themselves. But the government is perfectly free to compel a religious person to provide to others things that others need as part of their rights. If you have the right to get married, then the government has to allow you to get married, even if someone religious doesn't want to provide that marriage. Well, they don't have to serve in government. If you have a right to buy a cake and you have a cake person who serves straight people, they should serve gay people too. If they serve blacks, they have to serve whites. If they serve Christians, they have to serve Jews and Muslims and atheists. And that the easy way to think about it in my mind is, and I've said this before on the air, that religion should always be a shield, but not a sword. You can't force someone to eat pork if it's against their religion, but you cannot force others to practice your religion if they are not of your religion. Right? So if a baker holds itself out as we bake cakes, then they have to provide cakes for people. It's really a silly example because there's extremely few examples of this, but it's the one that conservatives always bring up. But I want to raise a larger question, and part of this comes out of the interview on Meet the Press that some of you may have seen with Republican presidential candidate Ben Carson, who was asked point blank if he could see himself, or not just himself, if he thinks America could elect a Muslim as president of the United States. And Ben Carson said, no. He said Islam is not consistent with the Constitution of the United States. Kind of made my jaw drop. I mean, a lot of people believe this kind of prejudice, but to say it on air? I don't think, or maybe I do think, I need to remind Ben Carson that in the Constitution, there is a specific provision that says there shall be no religious test to determine who is fit for office. The question is not, is a Muslim fit to be president? Of course a Muslim is fit to be president. Now, is an ISIS supporter fit to be president? I think not. But not because of the religion ISIS practices, but because ISIS believes in mass murder of non-believers. And I don't think we want any president who believes in mass murder of non-believers. I don't think we want a president who believes in killing abortion doctors, even if that person tells us that he or she is a good Christian. But it's not because of their Christianity that they can't be president. It's because they believe in murder. And the same would be true for the difference between an ordinary Muslim and one that belongs to an extremist terrorist group. But today I want to focus, in addition to the separation of church and state, as to how religion should infuse policymakers. Again, I don't think there should ever be religious discrimination. I think everyone should have the right to practice their religion as freely as they can, as long as it doesn't harm anyone else. Frankly, that's a principle I have about anything. I've long said I can throw my fists around and dance like a crazy person as much as I want, but my right to throw my fist ends where your face begins. Right? If I flail around wildly, I may look like an idiot, and you may laugh, but I'm really not hurting anybody except maybe my own reputation for dancing. But if I hit you, that's something totally different. If I choose, as I will choose, by the way, in three hours, I'm going to fast. The Jewish High Holy Day of Yom Kippur begins at sundown and ends the following sundown. In fact, we're not going to play a live show tomorrow. We're going to play probably the show I did on Katrina, which I thought was a really good show. I'll be back on Thursday. It is the holiest Jewish day of the year, and I will fast for 25 hours, no food or water. Yeah, not going to be easy. And I'll talk a little bit about why I do that this hour. But that is my choice. It's a choice I willingly do. It's not easy, trust me. It's not easy, but it's something that I willingly do. There's nothing wrong with that. And no government should ever force feed a Jewish person on Yom Kippur. That kind of makes sense. But neither should a government require everyone to fast on Yom Kippur. That would be just as oppressive, right? You could see, I don't know, a small town in New York State that's a majority Jewish town where they say, okay, everyone has to practice Yom Kippur. No one can eat. That would be a very oppressive government. There's a huge difference between using religion as a sword and using it as a shield. But in this hour, I also want to talk about how my religious values infuse my political values. And I'm going to invite you to do the same, calling in at 888-48-MARK, 888-48-6275. How is it that what you believe or what you don't believe, and that way it includes atheists and agnostics as well, how is it that your religious sensibility informs your political sensibility? For me, I very much believe that my Jewish religion, as I understand it, entails something called tikkun olam, repair of the world. And as we get into the holiest day of the Jewish year, I might as well talk about it, because my Jewish sensibility, my Jewish philosophy, very much infuses my political philosophy. And I have no problem at all with policymakers in government. When asked, why do you decide on this moral issue? They say, well, my religious teaching teaches me that life is important, that it shouldn't be easy to kill someone. And that's why, for example, I oppose easy access to guns. It's okay even to say, I believe that life begins at conception, and therefore I'm opposed to all abortion. I've never condemned anyone for having that view. They have a right to have that view for their religion. My condemnation only comes when it's imposed on everyone else. This is Mark Levine, toll-free number 888-48-MARK, 888-48-6275. We'll talk more about religion and politics when I come back after the break.
He's a Harvard economist and a Yale lawyer. He does not keep up with the Kardashians. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. On the occasion of the Pope's visit to the United States, and specifically the visit to Washington, by the way, he's coming to the White House and the Capitol. He's even going to speak before Congress. I've been thinking about the role of religion in politics. One, of course, is the constitutional role, and I talked a little bit about that, the wall of separation between church and state that Thomas Jefferson spoke of, the idea in the First Amendment that Congress cannot establish a religion or prohibit the free exercise thereof. But also the broader question of when should a policymaker use his or her own religion? I'm about to serve in the Virginia House of Delegates starting in January. To what extent do I take my own religious sensibility to my job? And I do. I certainly do. But maybe it's because my religious sensibility is very much one of tolerance of others' religions. That's something that I firmly believe. In fact, they teach in the Jewish teaching that we don't try to convert people. That's very different from Christianity, which tries to missionize, tries to win over converts. In fact, in the Jewish religion, if someone wants to become a Jew, you're supposed to turn them away three times. They say, you know, I really want to become a Jewish person. No, you don't. Don't do it. It's too hard. You'll be persecuted. It's a lifetime of study. It's too hard. I think you should stay what you are. Then they come to you a second time. You know, I really think I want to become a Jew. No, right. It's painful, and you're a minority, and you'll probably be mistreated, and there's so much philosophy, so much to learn. It's okay that you are what you are. God will accept you into heaven, according to the Jewish faith, if you're not a Jew. It's a lot easier. Then they come to you the third time, and then you say, okay, you really want to be a Jewish person, fine. We will teach you how to be a Jew. It takes 1 year of study. By the way, you can't just say, I'm a Jew and you're a Jew. The way you can, if you're a Christian, you can just say, I believe in Jesus and effectively you're a Christian. No, as a Jew, you have to go through a year of training. You have to go through a panel of three rabbis. It's very much like becoming a citizen of a country. You have to pass the test. You pass that test and you become a Jewish person. So my religion very much believes that others can serve God and serve humanity through their own religions. We don't require you to become our religion. So maybe because of that, I infuse that tolerance that it's part of my own religion into how I think of politics. And also I think being a minority, growing up as a Jewish person in Nashville, Tennessee, I recognize that minorities in particular have to be protected. So it really made me cringe when I heard Ben Carson say that a Muslim could not be president, that was inconsistent with our Constitution. But it's more than that. Part of Jewish teaching, and I'll get into this after the break, is what we call tikkun olam. That's Hebrew for repair of the world. The idea that we have an obligation to make this world a better place. It's not merely going and living and having a family and being happy, but that we must actively serve others. And no doubt, I take this into question as well. That doesn't mean I accept everything about Jewish teaching. I don't keep kosher. I'm no ways a perfect Jew by any stretch. But my inclinations, my religious inclinations, absolutely infuse what policies I support. And I'll talk more about that right after the break. If you want to call in, 888-488-MARK.
Back to the Aggressive Progressive, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Maybe I get more reflective as the Jewish High Holy Day approaches of Yom Kippur. This is the one day a year when Jews are supposed to think about all the things they've done over the past year, all the things they've done wrong, and repent of them. In fact, if these are really just things you've done against God or against your own faith, because if you've done wrong to others, the Jewish religion teaches, you have to seek forgiveness from the people you've wronged. You can't ask God for forgiveness for yelling at your wife. You have to ask her for forgiveness. That makes sense. But it also makes me think about how religion infuses policy, how it is that we determine what we're going to do based on our religion. And I think in many ways my public service is dictated, at least in part, by my religion. And I don't talk about my personal religion very often. Today's a good day to do it, since Yom Kippur begins tonight, and since the Pope is coming to Washington, D.C. And by the way, I'd love it if you would share your own religious sensibilities and how they infuse your political thought. Does religion make you a liberal? Does it make you a conservative? Does it affect it at all? Or your lack of religion, if you're an atheist, if that affects whether you're a liberal or conservative. Just call it at 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. But the Jewish religion, there's this wonderful notion in Kabbalah. Kabbalah is Jewish mysticism, basically. And it came out of the Middle Ages. And it's this idea that God is perfect. God filled the world. I feel like I'm preaching on air, which is not something I do very often. But God filled the world. But God was lonely, because God did not want, could not get love. Why can't God get love? Well, if God is all-powerful and creates everything, if God is omnipresent and awesome and all-powerful and the creator of everything, then who can truly love God? I mean, man can create a robot, and the robot can say, I love you. But is that love? Can a robot love you? No. You've just programmed a robot to say, I love you. That's not love. No. Love requires free will. There's absolutely no way to force someone to love you. The only way you ever get love is if someone decides by free will to give you love. And God knew that, because God knows everything. So he knew that in order to get love, true love, from his best creation, from mankind, from men and women, that he had to actually withdraw a little bit from the universe. You see, if God is all powerful at all times over and controls everything, then it's like the man that creates the robot. God cannot be loved by a creation that he requires love from. There's no such thing as forced love. So in order to get free will, God actually withdrew a bit from the universe. The great story of Adam and Eve. The whole point of that story is, what was the apple that Eve ate? What was it from the tree of? It wasn't the tree of life. It was the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Eve ate the apple. She shared it with Adam. They both, from eating that apple, suddenly had knowledge. They had knowledge of good and evil. And suddenly they had the ability to choose. They were not animals anymore. They could make choices. The essence of the difference between humanity and animals is that animals do most things by instinct, right? I mean, sure, I think your dog probably loves you, but true love, true choices, those are human decisions. It is humanity that most understands good and evil and can act thereby. That's why Jews don't believe in original sin. They don't believe that mankind is originally born evil. They believe that mankind is born as a blank slate, that every baby knows nothing when they're born, he or she is born, and the baby, him or herself, must choose, must be trained, must be taught, and must choose good and evil. So this Kabbalistic notion, this Jewish medieval notion, that God, in order to get true love, in order to not be lonely, had to withdraw a bit from the world, had to give mankind some freedom of choice, indeed a lot of freedom of choice. And it's this way that the Kabbalists explained evil in the world. What is evil? How can the great religious question, and that it's a tough question for any religion that believes in an all-powerful God and an all-good God, well, the question is, how does God allow evil to occur in the world? How can evil occur? How can the misery? In Syria, we're seeing millions of people in absolute misery being forced out of their homes or murdered. How can God allow such horrible misery? And the Jewish answer to that question is, God hasn't allowed it. Mankind has allowed it. That men and women, mostly men, unfortunately, have chosen evil and are doing evil. And that the only reason evil exists, the Kabbalists explain, with an all-powerful God who, after all, could just end it, is that God had to withdraw a bit from the universe to give mankind that free will. We don't believe in predestination. That free will that man has to choose good or evil. So the role of the person trying to do good, the role of the Jewish people, but not just the Jewish people, because Jews believe that anyone can fulfill this role, is tikkun olam. Tikkun actually means repair of the world. It's tikkun comes from the same Hebrew root as mending a stitch. You're literally stitching together the world again. When God withdrew from the world to give mankind free will, that was such an awesome withdrawal, such a terrible experience for the universe that used to be entirely filled with God's presence, that in withdrawing, it caused shudders. It caused the universe to break some. And in breaking, there are these shards of light that were created by God withdrawing from the world. And it is mankind's role to stitch together these shards of light and make the universe whole again. And when the universe is whole again, and God and mankind are acting one another together, then the Messiah will come and God will reign over humanity. Now, do I believe this is literally true? Nah, I don't believe it's literally true. Do I think there's shards of light out there in the universe, and that every time you do a good deed, a shard magically fits in place like a puzzle piece? No, I don't believe it's literally true. I believe in science. I believe in light. But it doesn't have to be literally true. It's not about science. This isn't about, you know, the actual shards of the universe and whether or not they make up today's comets or planets. That misses the point. I believe in science. But I also believe in this very nice notion. It doesn't matter to me whether it's literally true. Just like it doesn't matter to me that I believe in evolution, and I don't believe there was a single Adam and Eve humanity who literally ate from a fruit from a tree that was literally called the tree of knowledge of good and evil. I don't believe mankind had no knowledge of good and evil, ate an apple, and bingo, knew all about good and evil. I believe in evolution. I think these are mores taught over time. Ask me as a sociologist, as an evolutionist, about all the ways I think humanity developed notions of good and evil, and we can have a very interesting discussion. But it doesn't have to be true in a scientific sense to be true in a moral sense. Sometimes I think that liberals who reject religion, who reject Adam and Eve, who scoff at, well, of course the earth wasn't made in 6 days. Well, of course there was not a single man and woman created by God from dust. You know, men and women evolved from chimpanzees and apes and other primates. They're missing the point. There's a lot of beauty to the story of Adam and Eve. There's a lot of meaning, real meaning, without it being literally true. The idea that once you understand good and evil, that you have an obligation to do something about it, is something I firmly believe. Not that Adam and Eve were the first human beings and were literally true. No, but that with knowledge comes responsibility. Interestingly, we have this in the law as well, right? If you've got someone who is insane, who, when pulling the trigger of a gun at a human being, believes that he is at a shooting gallery and this is just a puppet and literally cannot tell right from wrong, they're not guilty by reason of insanity. Now, you might want to put them in an insane asylum for the criminally insane. We don't want these people out in the street hurting people, but they're not morally culpable. Maybe an easier example. A three-year-old picks up a gun, shoots his father, which happens. Lock your guns, people. Is the three-year-old guilty of murder? No. We all understand that a three-year-old does not have the knowledge, the capacity, the understanding to choose to know the difference between good and evil. It's a tragedy. It's awful. It's just as awful when your dog steps on your gun and shoots you. If that's possible, I suppose it is. But you get the point. With knowledge comes responsibility. This is an idea as old as the Hebrew Bible. It is an idea that dates back more than 3,000 years. And it makes sense. It is logical to me. My religious belief is logical to me. And if you say, well, Mark, you know, shards of light, are you kidding me? Stitch together the universe, what, a man gets this giant needle and thread and stitches together the planet, space, are you kidding me? You might as well believe in a flying spaghetti monster. I say you've missed the point. It's a beautiful concept. And we should live, I think, as if it's true. We should live in order to try to make the world a better place. And to me, that's not a bad influence of religion on politics. It actually dovetails very nicely, one with the other. Let me go to the lines, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Let's go to Susan from Ohio on line one. Hi, Susan. How are you?
I'm Susan from Pennsylvania. Hello?
Susan, are you there? Sorry, I couldn't hear you, Susan. I do want to hear from you, though. And if you want to post on my, if you're having trouble calling in, just post on my website at marklivingtalk.com. Tell you what, I'll take a break. We'll see if we can somehow get a good line in out to Susan. If you want to call in as well, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back right after this.
Never confuse Mark Levine with right-winger Mark Levin. The second E stands for empathy, which the other Mark lacks. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. It's Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Welcome back. I'm your host, Mark Levine, talking about religion in politics and where I think it actually is okay. I'm a firm believer in the separation of church and state. I'm a firm believer in science and evolution. But I think there are certain religious concepts like, the golden rule that we should do unto others as we'd have them do unto you that I think have universal application. And it's you don't have to believe in it to be a good policymaker, but it can't hurt if you do. So I don't think it's always bad to have policymakers who have a strong religious belief. Susan, you're back. Hopefully we can hear you better now in Philadelphia.
Yes, I'm here. Anybody can Google what the founding fathers have said about the separation of church and state. And I challenge anybody who does that to find one statement where they said that the United States was based on Christian beliefs, because that does not exist. People would like to think it exists, but it does not exist. So there is a separation of church and state. We were not founded based on Christian principles, and they should not be the overriding decision for politicians now or in the future.
Well, no, I mean, I agree. The country is not based on Christian principles. But there are certain, I think, religious principles that some get from religion and, frankly, that atheists get without religion. Things like we should look out for one another. Things like we should take care of one another. They are Jewish, they are Christian, they are Muslim, they are Buddhist and Hindu, but they're also principles that a good secular humanist would have as well, than atheist would have as well. So I certainly don't want government establishing any kind of religion, but I think it's fine if a representative makes clear where their values come from, because I think values do come from somewhere. They come from sometimes religion, they come from our families, they come from our life experiences. But it's okay for people to have values and to go into office as long as they clearly say where their values come from, isn't it?
Any value they want. My problem is when they want to impose those values on the public and me and say that that's the way it should be. It should not be the way somebody thinks it should be, because that's not what the founding fathers meant it to be, in my opinion, and in the statements of all the people I've ever read. I've never read anything from a founding father that says there should be an integration of church and state.
Well, look, so here's the deal. If these are values that we can all share, in other words, if someone comes in and says, my values are this, and you vote for them on those values, I'm fine with it. Unless, this is an important unless they regulate someone who has different values. In other words, let me be very clear. If my value is we should help one another, okay, I don't think that's something that some, we're not going to elect someone, he has this religious value that, that we're going to help one another. That's. But if someone has a religious value that says, I insist that you act according to my moral code, you have to keep kosher because I do. You can't get married because I don't think you should get married. You can't have an abortion because my religion says it's bad. That's a very different thing. That's using religion as a sword, not as a shield. And I agree with you. We should not elect representatives that want to impose their religion on someone else. But if the religion tells them we need to take care of the poor, the religion tells them that we have to look out for people who are oppressed, that we have to treat everyone well, that can be a religious sensibility as well as a non-religious sensibility. And there's no harm in that. I mean, Martin Luther King was a preacher. And many of his views were infused by religious views. So to me, the heart of the difference is whether they use religion as a sword or as a shield. And I agree with you. Religion should never be used as a sword. Let me just quickly go because I got one more call on the line. I'll give him a chance to speak. Let's go to Bill in New Mexico. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Mark. How are you? Thanks for taking my call. And, you know, you're on the right track with this thing. The God issue... We're founded on, we're supposed to be able to be free to practice any religion that we choose, but we don't impose it on others. So therefore, if that is true, then religion, the separation of church and state, you shouldn't even talk about it, shouldn't even discuss who you are religiously, what you believe religiously, but you can show what you are religiously by how you vote. Now, if I'm getting to the veteran situation, all the Republicans talk about, you know, for the veterans. But when it comes time to vote to fund something for the veterans, they all shut it down. So you tell me, How are they being real about things? They talk through both sides of their mouth. Now, where I'm going with this is the God thing. God allows you, like you said earlier, to have free will and choice. Now, in having free will and choice, you have the free will to do what you want to do. If you choose to shoot somebody under the guise of self-defense, war, or whatever. The Ten Commandments, simple 10-sentence declarations, are what, and we've gotten away from that because now we have the Ten Commandments that are in the law books and they fill law rooms all over the country, 16 feet tall and 50 feet wide, with law books telling you how you can get away with murder. That's wrong. That is a man choice.
Bill, I tell you, I got to wrap up because the show is about over, but I'll tell you, I really appreciate your comments. I do think that we've gotten a bit away from the Ten Commandments, but that's okay because the heart of, to me, what makes religion work in government is to the extent that it has universal applicability. So if you're talking about honoring your father and mother, well, that's something I think that we all can agree, that parents are important, that children are important. If it comes to honoring the Sabbath day, well, we may disagree on that, right? You know, I may celebrate on Saturday, a Muslim on Friday, and a Christian on Sunday. That's all part of the universalness of being an American. So all I'm saying is that when I go and I pray, starting this sundown to the next sundown, when I fast, I'll be thinking about how the religious teaching that I have will infuse how I make policy. And I'm okay with that as long as no one imposes a religion on someone else. So everyone have a happy Yom Kippur. I'll be back in 2 days. This is Mark.